Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. This is a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students across the state to come and sit with us for an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, the students are given materials about the case that we're about to hear, and they may engage in some outside activities relating to this case. They come, they listen to the oral argument, and then they meet with a justice who is assigned to discuss with the students and anyone else who wishes to come the procedures the court follows in accepting a case and hearing a case and deciding a case, but we do not discuss with the students the substantive issues of the case. Would anyone in the room like a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you'd raise your right hand, the marshal will give you a summary. All right. We will then introduce to you the members of the court, and then I'll call our first case. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. He will meet with you after the second case. Seated next to Justice Gableman is Justice Patience Robinsack. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her immediate right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call the case for this morning, 10-AP-355, Heritage Farms, Inc. versus Markel Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of Heritage Farms is Attorney Mark Thompson. Mr. Thompson.
Good morning, Chief Justice, fellow justices. As the court said, I am Mark Thompson. I'm with the law firm of Cannon and Dunphy, and I am here on behalf of the petitioners, appellants, and it's a pleasure to be back here again and an honor. With me is Brian Weisenstein, who, with the Curtis Law Offices, represents the Schwalkert plaintiffs together. In our brief, they are the Heritage Farms plaintiffs, some 20 property owners whose property was devastated by a fire that this court is very familiar with, having rendered a decision back in March 26, 2009. We are here to address the question of whether or not Heritage Farms is entitled to double damages under 26-21-1 in light of this court's prior ruling on March 26, 2009. Just as some background, Smokey the Bear and his famous warning, "Only you can prevent forest fires," is America's longest-running public service ad campaign in U.S. history. And I submit it is as relevant today as when it started in 1944, because wildfire prevention remains one of the most critical issues affecting our country. This court's prior decision, particularly paragraphs 29 through 35, set out all the reasons why the prevention of forest fires is crucial to Wisconsin's economy as well as to its recreation. Also, well over 100 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that state statutes providing for multiple damages are the most effective way of preventing harm to life and property. Specifically, in Missouri, R. Humes 115, Wis. 512, 1885, the court said, and I quote, "The statutes of nearly every state of the Union provide for the increase of damages when the injury complained of results from the neglect of duties imposed for the better security of life and property, and make the increase in many cases double, in some treble, and even quadruple the actual damages. Experience favors this legislation as the most efficient mode of preventing, with the least inconvenience, the commission of the injuries. The decisions of the highest courts affirm the validity of such legislation." Wisconsin Statute Section 2621, construed by this court in 2009, is exactly this type of favored legislation. It specifically provides for double damages, whereas here Heritage Farms not only proved negligence but also trespass and nuisance.
Counsel, I want to make sure that I understand the issues in this case. And thus far, you set forth the issue of whether Heritage Farms is entitled to double damages under the statute 26.21 sub 1. What are the other issues in this case? And is addressing the other issues at all dependent upon how we answer that threshold question?
Let me start with answering your first question. And I think it's appropriate because I wanted to clarify that in our conclusion at page 40 of our brief in chief, in terms of what we are seeking, which essentially sets forth what are the issues that this court needs to address, we need to make an important clarification. Number one is we are seeking double damages under 2621. Second issue, we are seeking statutory interest on the double damages from October 13, 2006, the date of the original verdict, until such damages are paid. We are specifically asking with respect to those two that this court specifically hold that this time, in the prior case it was implied but expressly state that Heritage Farms is entitled to the double damages and under Kempenny entitled to the statutory interest on the double damages. Third, we are also seeking statutory interest on the attorney's fees and costs awarded by the circuit court from the date of the jury's original verdict, and this is the point of clarification, and I apologize for the error. We said until February 12, 2010, the date such amounts were paid. Our mistake was when they were paid in February 12, 2010, it included interest from November 19, 2009, up through February 12, 2010. So we are not asking to recover interest that we've already recovered. And just so I want to be very clear, we're only seeking statutory interest on the fees awarded by the trial court from the date of the verdict until November 19, 2009. The fourth thing we're asking the court to do is, in light of those three, remand for not only the calculation of the interest on the two items represented, but also for a subsequent discretionary determination by the circuit court as to whether or not we're entitled to fees and costs on the double damages as well as on this appeal. Those are the general issues framed.
Counselor, just so I'm clear, there wasn't a cross-appeal on the actual award of attorney's fees under 2621 sub 1, correct?
Correct. There was not an appeal. It was paid. It's done. And so, and our mistake,
the interest component that we're talking
and
about.
And I just want to be very clear that we don't want to double dip. We're only asking for the window that we didn't recover on those.
Thank you.
Counsel, in response to my question on the issues, you set out four things. And to my ear, some of those were clarification on the relief requested as opposed to what are the issues presented. Let me toss that to you again.
Okay.
What are the issues?
Awesome.
No, that's okay. I may not have been clear. What are the issues presented in this case?
I think the first with respect to the double damages itself.
That's right.
Okay.
That's what you started out with, whether or not you're entitled to double damages under 26.21.
Right. It is our position that in light of this court's prior decision, particularly paragraphs 29, 35, and 41, where this court unequivocally held that it was the legislative determination that all tortfeasors are to be punished that to effectuate that meaning of the statute, this court has to then look at 26-21-1, the provisions of that, to, and clarify, in my mind, clarify that the plaintiffs may recover if they prove negligence. Clarify that in light of the following sentence where it says the trial court may award costs.
Let me...
I think that's an initial issue.
Let me clarify my question. I think I need to. On page 3 of your brief, you set forth two issues presented for review. Are those and do those remain the issues for us for review? And with regard to question issue 2, rather, that is set forth in page 3, if we would answer the first question that you are entitled to double damages, then I know that we have to address question 2. If the answer to the first issue is that there is no mandatory imposition of double damages, do we get to question 2?
There is an argument that the double damages or the fees awarded only associate whether there has been a finding of the double damages. That is an argument that has been made. I think in this case where they have been paid, that moots the issue. Now, we still don't, with respect to going back and asking for further damages, obviously, if you don't award us double damages here, we don't get back there. So in that sense, I think the issue is if it is determined that we are entitled to double damages in light of to effectuate the purpose of the statute, in light of cases that said that may can be construed as shall, if the statute demands that it's mandatory. And in this case, we submit that we established at trial that the defendant's negligence caused the fire. And this court last time said unequivocally that proof of mere negligence alone met and fulfilled the requirements of the statute. With respect to the issue that the Markell would like to raise, or that they imply that we don't get to the fees and costs if we don't get to the double damages, they've paid those already. And I think that rendered that issue moot. But I think a fair reading of the statute could be and should be that the award of fees is not dependent on the double damages. And I'll just explain why. 26-21-1. Reads, property owner, and that's private owners, us, in quotes, may recover in a civil action double the amount of damages suffered if the fires occurred through willfulness, malice, or negligence. That's one clause that uses may. The second clause in the same section or subsection starts, in a civil action, a court may award reasonable costs for legal representation to provide owners recovering damages under this subsection. Now, to read the second provision, that they're only entitled to fees if they're entitled to double damages, it was paid below, and there was no issue as to how do you construe that? But if you were going to fulfill the purpose of the statute, if it is that you try the case, in this one, 4 weeks, dispute, the jury rejected their view of the facts. They determined that they knew it was hot, they didn't put it out, and they let the fire escape, causing great damage. When you accept the representation of these individuals, you are looking at you're telling them there's two components. You're entitled to double damages and your fees. And it's a remedial statute, and it should be liberally construed to give full effect to the provision. So when you read it then in conjunction with sub 2, because the Markell makes the argument, because sub 2 has the phrase shall, and sub 1 only uses one, that somehow the may, in both instances, may recover as well as the trial court may award, should be discretionary as opposed to mandatory. We think that that rationale in this case doesn't apply. First of all, this court already noted in paragraphs 22 and 23 of its initial decision that 2621 itself and its two subsections were dissimilar in many ways. And it was part of that. One is 26.1 was from the vantage point of those who were recovering, and sub 2 was from the tortfeasor's vantage point. And so it said we're going to look at this differently. In looking at sub 2, it talks about an action for debt as opposed to a civil action. My recall, action for debt really looks at it as an action. It's not really in contract or tort. In this case, the state and municipalities simply can enforce in debt for that amount certain, which is their expenses. In light of that certainty, the use of shall there makes sense. Then you go back to 26.1, and then you look at the two uses of may. If you're really going to construe 26.1 and the uses of may in both sections, this court has to go to its rules of statutory construction. The court has, and the courts have held in numerous cases, Hitchcock versus Hitchcock, Miller versus Smith, Surridge, Schmidt, all cases where the legislature used the word may, but to give effect to the purpose of the statute, it was construed shall. So to me, logically, it flows this way. This court has already ruled that the legislature determined to punish all tortfeasors. It was not up to the trial court, circuit court, or the court of appeals to disregard that legislative mandate and substitute their decision for the legislature by finding that we needed to prove more than negligence, or that we had to have an element of recklessness to imply some kind of punitive damage argument. These statutes, and in particular Hartlaub, pointed, you know, the Lemon Law statute, at one point in time it was written using the same kind of may recover language. And the Court of Appeals there said a party does not prove multiple or double damages. The jury determined that Coachman had violated the statute and the Hartlaubs had incurred pecuniary loss. As such, the additional damage provisions were triggered by operation of law. We submit that in light of the court's mandate that all tortfeasors are to be punished, and that was the legislative determination, that it must operate as a matter of law that may recover double damages. That gets us to the second provision, the second may in 26.21.1. A trial court may award reasonable cost for legal representation. That may is not tied to the if. It is not in the context of a jury making a determination and finding. It simply says that post-verdict, the trial court may award costs. In this case, the trial court looked at the history of fee-shifting statutes, and we find that it correctly determined that it was in the interest of furthering the purpose of the statute that the plaintiffs be awarded those fees, and did not tie the recovery of that to the damages under this subsection.
Counselor, why do you think the legislature used willful malice and negligence rather than just saying anybody that negligently caused a forest fire should get double damages? Why do you think they had all three of those in there?
I can only assume that they meant to be very clear that all conduct entitles the injured party in this case the private owners, the damages. And I think this court in its prior decision was pretty clear on that. It said there was no requirement for gross negligence. The legislature, when they amended the statute in 1977, included all three.
But it's been in all three since the statute was put together in 1905.
Can say is I'm assuming that they wanted to be very clear that it meant willfulness, malice, or negligence. And could they have used your terminology, meaning all? Yes. Beyond that, I can't say. But what was very clear from this court's last decision is that proof of negligence was sufficient because it was the legislative determination that they be punished. And below this court, the lower courts, essentially ignored that mandate, substitute their judgment, and implicitly the Court of Appeals decision guts the prior decision.
Well, I think what they did is they interpreted May as discretionary, and I think they looked to our opinion for guidance, and we said that it was applicable to those who start forest fires, not just folks that run railroads, which was, I think, an alternate position in that case. And we said they put it together to punish, but I don't think we ever really talked about the May or the shall concerns that you're bringing to us now.
No, I you're right on that. And what I have said is that the court's holding that the legislature had determined that the negligent tortfeasor is to be punished was the mandate. It didn't say then it should go back to say how much they should be punished. It should be just punished. And that's why we submitted in our briefs, because it is a remedial statute. It's double damages. It is in the nature of a penalty that this court and the lower courts, in construing these types of statutes, have interpreted the May to be mandatory if the interpretation demanded such. In this case, we also argued to the trial court that at least there was a presumption. And then when the trial court said, well, what I'm looking for is evidence that somehow the tortfeasors knew it was hot, we reminded the trial court of what the record showed, that the Markle defendants, when they put that fire out originally, knew that they hadn't fully extinguished it. They breached that just basic Smokey the Bear motto. They failed to extinguish it. They had water. They didn't use it. They left knowing it was a holdover fire. If you don't construe the May recover as mandatory, it is a completely arbitrary provision, and the ultimate outcome in terms of utilizing the factors is what kind of standard applies then under the circumstances. If you do everything the legislature says, you prove negligence. This court says you don't need to prove more than that. And then the trial court says, but there's different types of negligence. But this court says, no, it's just negligence. Or that now we have a burden of persuasion. That's not in the statute. They're applying a different legal standard. Or they're saying we got to see who merits punishment. But that's a punitive damage question.
Counsel, I want to follow up on Justice Rogensack's question. If the legislature in 26.21, sub 1, within the if clause, had just had negligence, the if clause currently reads, if the fire occurred through willfulness, malice, or negligence, what would be the import of just having negligence and not having willfulness or malice?
I think if it was left alone, it could create a real anomaly where the more culpable conduct doesn't suffer the same type of double damage penalty.
That's what, yeah.
And I think it's clear from reading the statute, its history and this court's interpretation, that there's agreement that if it's willfulness, malice, you're entitled to the double damages. The issue was whether negligence was enough or whether you needed negligence plus. And this court has already ruled we don't need negligence plus. But the lower courts somehow say we need negligence plus. And that's why we're asking this court to construe it as a matter of law, by operation of law, that if you establish the statutory requisites, you're entitled to double damages.
Counsel, there is something that is easy about the legislature. If the legislature wants to say shall, they write shall. If they want to say may, they write may. Here they wrote in sub 1 may. They wrote it twice. And the next sentence after sub 1 begins sub 2, and they use the word shall. And in sub 2, they use shall twice. Clearly, they know how to use may, and they know how to use shall. It seems to me that some of the cases that you cite that deal with may really means shall don't have this context one sentence after the other, and also rely on the principle that may can be shall when an interpretation of may, my words, not theirs, decimates the purpose of the statute.
And I think that's what I attempted to identify, the sort of the unique nature of 2621 and these two subsections. This court already previously noted that the two subsections don't naturally go together. And rules that govern the subsections are not necessarily applied. And I attempted to point out that Sub 2 has a different focus, it's from a different point of view, and it addresses an action for debt. That subsection could actually be a different section, because in many ways, Sub 1 and 2, as together now, don't logically fit together. So, taking my cue from what the court has already identified, then I looked at the use of may in two different ways in sub one. If may has to mean, if it's given its meaning, then it has to be in context. One says the plaintiffs may recover if, in the event that they prove willfulness, malice, or negligence. We did that and more. Nuisance and trespass. We agree in the civil action a court may award. In that context alone, without the conjunction of if or in the event that, it is discretionary. We argue that to the trial court, and the trial court says we're going to award it because to not do so would be to deprive the plaintiffs the benefit of the remedial statute.
Counsel, can I just, I know your red light is on. Let me
just
give you something to either think about, or maybe it's an unfair question. I don't intend to ask either of you an unfair question. But this chapter deals with protection of forest lands and productivity. When you look at the different sections throughout this chapter, for example, 2609 deals with civil liability for if somebody trespasses and cuts down some of your trees or removes them from your property, not burns it or something like happened here. It's a different section. But the legislature there made real clear when double damages or when four times the value will be awarded. I recognize that the history indicates that was enacted after this statutory section, 2621. You know, on one hand, it looks like the legislature knows how to make it real clear if you're supposed to get double or four times the value, because it seems like pretty clear language. On the other hand, why would the legislature, do you think, decide that if someone cuts down your tree, you should get double or four times the value, whereas if someone burns down your property, you may or may not? Tell me what you think about that. It may be an unfair question.
If I may?
Yes, counsel.
No, I don't think it's an unfair question. I think in large part this court addressed it previously in the sense that this isn't a perfectly drafted statute. It is unique in its history in some ways, And it's not maybe what we would say it's an ideal. But it's clear that the language of 2621(1), as construed by this court, said that the legislature intended to punish all those that caused forest fires, willfulness, malice, or negligence. I think that's as clear as saying shall. And in this context, it says may recover if, in the event that. It didn't say the trial court may award double damages. It didn't say that. That it said about legal fees and costs. So could they have said it differently? Yes. Is it sufficiently clear? I think it is. And I think it should be applied to Markell. This court's earlier decision said as applied to Markell. And I think this is a question of clarifying that Heritage Farms, those plaintiffs, are entitled to double their damages and interest. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Chief, may I ask?
Justice Prosser.
Was the jury aware of the prospect of double damages?
No.
Was the jury asked anything other than to find negligence?
No.
Why did the trial take 4 weeks?
There were, to be fair, a couple of weeks that were not complete. I think more than anything, it was the number of plaintiffs and the damages that you had to prove for each plaintiff. Essentially, it was 18, 20 sets of plaintiffs. There was a lot of time spent on the individual damages proved. With respect to the liability, it was essentially, I think, Mr. McCoy, my recollection is we were done in a week and he was done in a few days, so it was like seven days, the essence of the liability issues, and the rest was spent on what was a complex damage case. I mean, you have 572 acres. A lot of those were Heritage Farms. You had some of the plaintiffs were in the tree business. They were in the business. So, you know, they had tree loss versus, you know, just the calculations. There were all sorts of different elements of damages. We called it three seasons because it was when we started, it was almost 90. We had fall, and the last day, it was snowing, so we call it three seasons. Thank you much.
Well, we may be into several years. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. John V. McCoy, representing Markell Insurance Company. Mr. McCoy.
Give me one second. Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court, I have the honor today to be in front of you again on this case on behalf of all the defendants. That includes Lake of the Woods, which is a campground where the fire started, Markell Insurance, Jeffrey Knack, and his insurance company, American Family. The issues that we believe the court has to address is, first of all, whether the award of double damages under this statute is discretionary. Second, whether the trial court, when rendering its decision, made the correct decision. And third, whether interest applies to that award or any award that the court might consider before that has actually been awarded. First of all, in dealing with the issue of discretion, if you look to the statute, it is clear that the word says may in both instances where it discusses the kind of awards or damages that may be provided. Kalal stands for the concept that the court should assign words their ordinary and accepted meaning. And may generally has been interpreted to be just that, to be discretionary. We have looked at all of the cases that have been cited in the state of Wisconsin that interpret the word may or shall. And if the court looks at the actual language of all of those cases, there's only one case that has ever interpreted the word may to be mandatory, and that is the case of Miller versus Smith. And in that particular case, an action was brought regarding a personal injury against the state of Wisconsin and an employee by the name of John Doe. And the court said in order to effectuate judgment and to get an award, you had to identify who John Doe was. And even though the statute said that you may amend to identify the individual, in order to effectuate the purpose of that statute, you had to identify the individual. Outside of that, every case has interpreted may to be discretionary. Statute doesn't say who gives permission under this particular case, but it does, in our position, the decision was made by the trial court. In this particular case, the legislature could have worded otherwise. In other words, they could have said shall, as it did in sub 2 under 26.21, where it clearly used that language. Now, remember that this statute was amended in 1977. And in 1977, it was a composite or single statute. And in this particular case, it was broken apart in sub 1 and sub 2. And clearly, we are supposed to assume that the legislature knew what it was doing when it crafted the statute. There's been reference in prior argument about 26.09, where double damages are clearly defined under that statute. And my perception of the difference of that statute is cutting down trees can't be, in my view, accidental. If you're going to cut down a tree, I think you have to make a decision intentionally to do it. In this particular case, at least the case before the court, we're dealing with a negligent act. And the court, in its decision back in March of 2009, did indicate that the statute did suggest that all tortfeasors should be potentially subject to punishment. At least that is our interpretation. It did not say that every case involving a forest fire must mandatorily require the imposition of double damages.
Counselor, if I were to agree with that argument, what are the parameters under this statute that the trial court should have applied?
In this particular case, there is no particular standard that was articulated to the court, but we believe in order to award punishment damages, which the court has articulated these are, the appropriate standard would be clear and convincing evidence. And we believe the court in this particular case did not find clear and convincing evidence to award punishment damages under this portion of the statute.
Convincing evidence of what?
That
of what?
Well, as the court describes, it's something more than slight negligence. In other words, the idea is to deter conduct that the court or that the legislature deemed should not occur, to send a signal to the general populace that this type of activity cannot be warranted so that people will be vigilant in preventing it. And in this case, it is very fact-specific, and whether the trial court made the appropriate decision really involves an abuse of discretion standard, and we believe that the court articulated in its oral decision a reasoned basis for making the decision not to award double damages in this case.
Counsel, do you think then that a jury should decide if something is willful or malicious or negligent? And if negligent, should there be different kinds of negligence so to guide the court on when double damages would apply? I think I hear you saying, if this were intentional, and they intentionally set the fire, then this would be a double damages case, because that would be the kind of willful, malicious, intentional act, like going in and cutting down someone else's trees. Then it'd be a double damages case. But because it's just negligence, it's not a double damages case. Am I hearing you correctly?
Generally, yes. I think there is a distinction. I think there are spectrums where it's one kind of like a pendulum. At some point, the court says this is not a case that warrants double damages, and I can explain the facts in this case to think support it. But clearly, for instance, a case of arson.
So you think it's not a jury question? That was the first part of my question.
Fair enough. We do argue in this case that in order to impose punishment, that there should be an opportunity to present this to a jury. In this particular case, the trial judge decided we support the court's decision that they should not award, but certainly the opportunity should be permitted to let the jury hear this case. And in fact, remember, this was something that could have been put on the verdict at the time of trial, but was not, whether or not double damages should be awarded in this case. And it was only...
That wouldn't be the question, I don't think. I think the question would be, is it malicious or willful or something more than just a little bit negligent? If I'm hearing you right. The question wouldn't be jury decide if it should be double damages. That's a court's responsibility to double the damages after the damages are determined, right? But the question of the jury would be, is it willful? Is it malicious? Is this intentional? If I'm hearing you correctly.
No,
I mean,
this isn't
a punitive damages case where the jury would determine punitive damages. It's a, you know, a dog bite, for example. A jury doesn't determine what the trouble or what the damages might be. The jury determines what are the damages for the dog bite, and then the court decides what you do with those damages. I think typically the doubling or the tripling or quadrupling would be a court responsibility after the jury reaches a verdict of what damages are due. Or has something changed that I...
Well, I think typically the trial judge does make that decision, and the question becomes whether that... I don't think the issue has ever been addressed, whether or not that is a decision that only a judge can make or whether a jury can make this. It's different than a dog bite statute where it's mandatory under the present statute. And the Hartlaub case, which they discussed, used the May language, and the subsequent case which we provided to the court last week, which is the Hughes case, actually says that up until that time, it was permissive. And I want to get into that, but I want to address your point. In this particular statute, you aren't only entitled to double damages if you prove... let me see the statute. I think it's malice and willfulness. The statute says you potentially can get them if it's negligent. So to the degree that I'm impressing upon you that I was limiting to nothing, everything excluding negligence, then you misunderstand
then
my position.
Then what's the standard? I'm just putting myself in the trial court judge's position. The statute says if you've got a fire, you can recover these damages. The damages may be double. I'm the trial court judge. Had a trial. The jury said these are the damages. It's clean that way. If you have the jury decide, well, I could double these, or I just want to double this part of it, or I want to, how would you know whose are doubled and whose aren't, and what makes sense and what does? I mean, if you have a jury determine what the damages are, then the judge doubles it. You know what you've got, and you know how they base their decision. It makes some sense, it seems to me. So I'm the judge. When do I double it? When don't I? Or is it just completely a discretionary decision and every trial court judge in every fire case can decide, I think this is a double damages award. Or the trial courts can say, nah, I don't think it is. Or are you saying that the judge should submit that to the jury? So for each plaintiff, the jury determines whether there's double damages for that one plaintiff. When the rubber hits the road, how does it work for the trial court
judge?
Well,
in a typical forest fire case, there's only one event, and all damages flow from it. So I don't believe, practically speaking, that there's a different analysis as to each damages. What other damages are caused by the fire, they're all caused by the same event, and you're punishing the causing action. There's only one causing action, the starting of the forest fire. And so you look at the damages, and if the court believes that in its discretion, this is an appropriate case to exact punishment for that type of activity, it can do so. The clear and convincing standard is the standard that should be applied in applying punishment. The statute does not speak to it. Traditionally, historically, it is the trial judge who makes that decision. And even in the Hartlaub case, remember, the appeal was that the jury should have been able to decide that decision because they were seeking an option. And the decision there was no, the judge makes that decision. I agree, that is typically what has been done. The question in this case is whether the court made the appropriate decision. It articulated a factual basis for that, and I believe the court, in interpreting that statute, it is discretionary. It looks at the facts, so applied the right law, and it determined, based upon those facts, that this is a forest fire that was a holdover fire. The burn occurred on March 3rd. The fire occurred on April 14th. The gentleman who handled that fire was Jeffrey Knack. He was there. He said he put sand and snow on it. Snow is moisture, it's water, despite what appellant's counsel has told you. He thought the fire was out. Yes, it was hot. When I turn off my gas grill, I know it's off, but it's still hot. And that's the point he tried to make. For the next 6 weeks, on a daily basis, that Lake of the Woods, which is approximately a 300-acre campground, traveled around that area every day looking to see if there was fire. There were several snowfalls, and no one was able to determine that there was a continuing fire. That is what I view to be a reasonable effort at trying to stop this. And do you punish someone for those type of activities? The trial court, in its discretion, decided no.
I'm not trying to. Can you just tell me, does the jury determine this or not? And does the jury answer willfulness, malice, negligence, or not? Does the jury double the damages or not? Just
okay.
I understand your facts. There's, you know, they're sympathetic things.
My answer is.
But that's not the issue. I have to figure out who gets double damages and what does the statute mean, so people know consistently how to reasonably apply it.
With the statute we're living with, traditionally a trial judge makes it. We make an argument that the option should be given for a jury trial. If whoever makes that decision.
So what are the parameters? Is it just a discretionary call? If you think it wasn't that bad, don't award double damages. If you think it was really bad, award double damages. Is that what we tell trial court judges? Totally in your discretion, you make the call.
It has to be clear and convincing. In this case, the court determined it was slight. I don't think it is what courts make decisions like that all the time. They look at the facts and they say, is there clear and convincing evidence that I should punish in this case? Does a jury or a judge have to say, do I have to find malice or willfulness? No. You can find it in negligence. So the underlying case may ask that question of willfulness or malice in the special verdict. But in a negligence case, where that's the finding, they do not have to find, in addition, willfulness or malice in order to award double damages, but they have to find some clear and convincing evidence of a reason to impose punishment. Now, we do argue under this.
May I ask this question? Suppose Judge Finn had awarded double damages on these facts.
Yes.
What would your position have been then?
We think that there would not have been justified because in this particular case, there was a diligent effort to attempt to make sure there was no fire. It's pretty unusual from our experience.
But, I mean, would you have attacked his exercise of discretion on some legal basis? Or what
you'd have to attack it on an abuse of discretion basis. And, you know, candidly, if the court makes a decision based on its discretion, and you're arguing abuse of discretion, that's an uphill sledding, and that's a difficult argument. So strategically, you may have to say, even though I disagree with the court, unless I have a really clear argument that that discretion was abused, that's going to be a tough challenge. But that's the only option you would have.
Suppose we had a case involving arson, and after the trial, the judge did not impose double damages. What then?
Well, and we're assuming now I'm the plaintiff now because the plaintiff would appeal that. If I'm a defendant, I would say that's great. But if it's a plaintiff, I would think they would, because I am the, you know, so, and I assume you're saying I'm aggrieved by that, so I must be the plaintiff. So I put on that hat and I would say, of course I would appeal, and I think you have a better argument that that is an abuse of discretion because as you look at the pendulum, clearly that's on the far side, intentional act.
The judge gives some reasons. The arsonist was a minor, and I mean, this got way out of hand, and they didn't really.
Generally speaking, if you talk about arson generally, but of course, it depends upon the facts of the case. There might be a factual situation where malice may not warrant double damages. I can't articulate a case, but certainly, you know. The law is based upon experience, and each case is dependent upon the facts. All I know is in this case that's not true.
Isn't your position really taking any certainty out of this double damages provision and really gutting its effectiveness?
Well, it's not my position. I would take the position that's how the statute is drafted, and there. The statute does allow a reasonable understanding that you may be subject to double damages if, in the view of the court, there's a need to impose penalty. And that is not an uncommon method by which penalties are imposed. The threat of being penalized is a deterrent in this case. And certainly it's a deterrent for more serious acts.
I understand your argument, I think the same thing is bothering Justice Ziegler, Justice Prosser, and me, is how does this statute work? If it's truly discretionary and someone willfully starts a forest fire,
The judge has the discretion to say, no, I'm not going to double the damages. Or if you don't like your neighbor, and so you burn his back 40, and it gets to 570 acres, the judge can still say, ah, you did it with malice. That's why that was the event that started it. But I still have the discretion not to award double damages, right?
He has the discretion to make that decision, but there are error-correcting courts, and that is the remedy that's available to. Obviously, that's how this case came to the court, because the appellants believe that there were error initially, and they believe there's error again. And
I know,
that's
but
the
trial court, the trial court complained bitterly that we didn't tell him what to do with this statute. He said, I know I'm supposed to apply punishment, because that was something that was in our opinion, but he wasn't quite sure what he was to do with it. You know, and if it's discretionary, that means he can say no if someone, as Justice Prosser suggests, starts a fire intentionally because they don't like their neighbor. I think we're still going to be giving the court a lot of trouble if we accept your argument, because although you say, well, he does it by clear and convincing evidence, that isn't in the statute either, but it still doesn't give you clear and convincing evidence of what? I mean, the legislature says if you do any of these three, you at least have, under your theory, the opportunity for double damages, right? But you also have the opportunity not to get them.
Well, that's the idea of discretion. And I guess I would say you were implying that a trial court is going to make a decision that is clearly inconsistent with what we believe most judges would do. I mean, every judge I've been in front of, I think, tries to do what they think is the appropriate thing. And they try and determine whether in a particular case there's clear and convincing evidence for punishment to be awarded. There's no indication in this case that this trial judge did not do that.
Counsel, and I can to follow up and maybe to be more pointed with regard to Justice Rogensack's question. Month in and month out, both in civil and criminal cases, this court interprets statutes. And in interpreting statutes, we oftentimes have to come up with, divine, if you will, factors that the court should consider in exercising discretion under the statute. I mean, we have case after case where we have to come up with factors for the proper exercise of discretion or to aid or to assist in the exercise of discretion. What factors should be considered here or in future cases in exercising the discretion you espouse exists under the words of the statute?
Well, I mean, I talk about the clear and convincing standard.
That's a standard. What factors?
The factors to me are, in looking at the facts of this case, is this the type of activity that demonstrates a complete disregard for safety? And if so, is there potentially a recurring activity that this person has been subject to this type of behavior in the past?
What about a disregard of property?
I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, you say the activity was in disregard of safety. Here, property was damaged. Is it disregard of property, too?
Well, I think that's part of disregard of safety when you're dealing with a forest fire. And you are certainly have the understanding that it could damage property around. And if you look at the statutory definition of forest, is extremely broad, where it could apply to really just about any kind of land outside of maybe a home inside of a city, the land surrounding it. So it's a very broad application. But, I mean, in this particular case, the court did not identify the clear and convincing standard, but it did articulate the factual basis for its decision. And
what was the factual basis for the decision? What were the facts the court considered in exercising consideration?
Partly, he did give some examples, but the idea that this fire that caused the April 14th fire resulted from a forced burn that occurred on March 3rd when there was snow on the ground. The individual who was doing that put sand on it, put snow on it. He thought it was out. There was no smoke rising out of it. It certainly was hot, but as I described, when you turn off a grill, it's still hot even though it's not burning. After that, people came by that area every day on their ATV. Within feet of it, people actually put things on that fire over the next 6 weeks on a daily basis, and no one determined that there was any indication of smoke or heat coming out of that. And it was not until 6 weeks later, after an extreme drought and a high wind, that the sand was uncovered, and some, according to the facts of this case, a fire was erupted from embers that flew out of that. And these are efforts that this Lake of the Woods had employed for many, many years, safely. And certainly they are very concerned about forest fires as well. They have their campground is 300 acres of forest. And they have very strict rules about where things should be dumped. They have three separate piles. Embers should be going in a ditch that should be where they can't blow out. And then there's area where things can't be burned, and then a burn pile. And they made very clear that they would keep those separate, that they would monitor them on a daily basis, and that they had instructions for people to use so that they could everything they could to avoid fires. In this particular case, the gentleman pulled a permit at a time when permits were not required. And the permit, in order to let the state know that he was burning, he wasn't required to do that for another 3 weeks. But he went beyond what was required in order to let people know, in order to be safe. And I think those are the kind of facts that this trial judge used in rendering the decision that this is not an appropriate place to award damages. Now, I'm not sure. I have a yeller, so I want to get to two more issues. One is the interest. The liquidated damages is the test for when damages can be awarded. And if you look at the cases that discuss this, there's the they cite the Kempenny case, but that was a case required dealing with a dog bite where the statute was shale. So they should have been awarded originally. In this case, it's May, so that's distinctive. And secondly, the Ziegler case is the case that is more on point, and it says interest is computed on the date that damages become liquidated. The damages were liquidated on reverse when it was sent back down, and we paid interest from the time the court rendered that decision until they were actually paid. With regard to double damages, because they are discretionary, they haven't been awarded. So there's no basis to award interest. At least that's the position we take.
Counselor, but are you objecting to paying interest on the attorney's fees that were awarded?
Well, we already paid the interest. The point we make is that if you read the statute closely, and we acknowledge we did not cross appeal on this issue, but they are only awarded if damages are awarded under this section. In footnote 2, we do cite to...
No, we're not talking about damages because you didn't appeal that issue. That's not before us. The attorney's fees and costs are a done deal, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All I want to know is, do you object to that window of interest that would have occurred if the attorney's fees had been awarded at the time the verdict came down?
Yes, because they were never presented to the court until it was sent back down, so there's no opportunity for us to pay.
Okay. That's what I need to know. Thank you.
If there are no other questions.
Bart, I have another question. And that is, in response to several questions from the bench, including questions from Justice Ziegler and Justice Prosser, about does the jury do the double damages or does the court do the double damages assessment, in your brief you make the Apprendi argument, and that you have, under Apprendi, you say, a right to a jury trial on damages that are imposed beyond that given by the jury. That's the argument you advance. The counter to your Apprendi argument, your constitutional argument, is you waived it. Number one, tell me why you haven't waived that constitutional argument. And then number two, if you think you haven't waived it, why aren't you asserting it here in response to questions from the bench? I didn't understand that.
Well, I think we have attempted to argue that we are entitled to a jury trial. The issue is we believe that the court made the right decision, so there's no reason to go back to it. If the court decides that the trial judge needs to make that decision, it would be entitled to do that. The rightness issue is until the damages are awarded, there's no basis to appeal. We argue that in our brief, and that's the position that we take, that until they are actually awarded, It's not a position where those issues are ripe. When they first were awarded, they become ripe, and then on the appeal, we raise those issues.
Have you waived the constitutional argument?
No, I don't believe we have, because the issue does not arise until the damages are awarded, and that's when we raise the issue. I think that's what I was trying to say. They are not ripe until they are awarded, and then the constitutional issue comes into play.
At trial court, you won. At the trial court level, you won on the basis of double costs, right?
Yes.
As a statutory matter.
I'm sorry.
At the trial court, you won the issue that there shall be no double damages.
Initially, correct.
And you won it on the basis of the interpretation of the statute.
That it only applied to railroads, correct.
Therefore, you didn't have to assert a constitutional issue of damages, right?
Right, that's our position.
Okay. When you were in the Court of Appeals on the issue of double damages,
yes.
Did you assert that the constitutional issue?
If we're talking the first appeal, the issue of double damages wasn't presented. It's whether the
statute
applied.
Talking about this appeal, this case.
I believe we did.
In the Court of Appeals?
Yes.
All right. And then when you come here, you assert the issue, right?
Yes.
You assert the issue here to defend the Court of Appeals decision, in effect.
Well, we do defend the Court of Appeals decision. I don't know that there's a link there.
Maybe there isn't, because if you were right on the constitutional issue and there were double damages, it would have to go back and be retried, wouldn't it?
If the court determines, yes, they would have to be tried. That would be our
position. The position is it's not waived because you didn't have to make it at the trial court.
Correct.
And you did make it at the Court of Appeals.
Yes.
And you do make it here.
Yes.
Okay.
At the original trial, there was an issue of whether double damages could be awarded to plaintiffs who were not railroad, or against defendants who were not
right.
Railroads. Was the circuit court's decision made before trial or after trial on that issue?
I think it was raised before trial, and this is my memory, so the record, you have to rely on the record, but certainly before the issue was, I think before closing arguments, before a verdict was submitted, the court had decided that issue because I think it was critical in deciding, I think, how to form the verdict.
What I'm really getting at is, did the plaintiffs have the opportunity or duty to present to the jury evidence that this would justify double damages? This case would justify double damages?
I would tell you that it's my view that that issue was not presented to the jury. It was not requested that it be presented to the jury after the court rendered its decision. And the question is whether there should have been an offer of proof or a request to make that argument to the jury on an advisory basis in the event an appeal was taken. I know those actions were not taken, and I can't tell you legally at this point without thinking more about it whether that was required, but procedurally those are options that were available that I do not believe were exercised. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCoy. Mr. Thompson, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you very much. The issue of whether or not Heritage Farms is entitled as operation of law to double damages, I think, is one, and I suggest that the court should find in that regard for some very practical reasons. Paragraph 29 of this court's earlier decision says, in quotes, as a practical matter, it makes sense that the legislature would choose to severely punish all forest fire starting tortfeasors rather than just railroads, given the importance of forests and ecology in this state. In paragraph 41, this court says, in quotes, if the legislature did not intend to include those who act negligently, it could have deleted the word negligence. If the legislature did intend to include those who act negligently, what else could have it done but use the word negligence? We owe deference to that legislative determination to punish those who set forest fires, whether willfully, maliciously, or negligently. See supranote 9 in paren, stating that the legislature says in a statute what it means and means in a statute what it says. If this court does not hold as a matter of, as operation of law, or at a minimum, that this creates a presumption in Heritage Farms' benefit, we have a meaningless provision. We have a remedial statute that will never be given meaning. It will never be given effect. The court has said where may is used and to construe it as shall is demanded. I suggest that this is the case. Because what we ended up with was with the circuit court, who at one level was in a quandary. We did point out that there are these cases that say may should be construed as shall when it is operation of law, and that there is a presumption, and that the court has been very clear that the legislature said to punish. Now, as a result of ignoring that mandate, there has been no punishment.
Now, and I'm trying to recall, I think the last time this case was here, and I could be wrong, I'm going to have to look it up. I thought Markel was arguing that to receive double damages under 2621 sub 1, one must have violated 2620. And then we decided that's not the case. But I thought that was part of the argument before.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of it. But I'm reading what the language in the court says in terms of how it ultimately construed the statute.
But and if we were to read 2621, I won't interrupt you anymore, I'm sorry.
No.
Could it be read that you can settle for the damages under 2620 if you're the kind of person who can recover under 2620, but if you're someone else who can recover under other areas, you can bring in a civil action, a double damage claim. That either A, you can settle for 2620 damages if you want to, or you can recover in a civil action double damages.
Right. In this case, we pursued under 2621 that we may recover double damages if, and we proved the if.
Counselor, didn't you really sue under 2614 sub 9? It has identified exactly what's in your special verdict as the kinds of damages you can see.
No, I don't have the complaint, but we allege 2621, and that was just to address Justice Prosser's question and just to clarify Mr. McCoy. It was decided on summary judgment before we got to the jury, and Here is the issue. We have negligence as a question, and the jury found negligence. And going before the judge, and this is, if you're not going to construe and look at the legislature's intent, and you're not going to read what this court said, then you are at a position of who do you decide to punish? But the court said the legislature decided to punish if you're negligent. And so then we went back and we had this discussion. But we ended up talking about a fire at Miller Park in the parking lot. And that didn't make any rational sense. It was completely arbitrary in terms of if you're going to give any meaning to it. And I say, as a practical matter, if you're going to provide guidance to the courts, there is a line of cases that says if it's a remedial statute, give it effect, enforce it, hold that it's mandatory. And with respect to the questions not before this, if it is willful or malicious, the court can simply, that's not here. We do have a negligence finding. The jury did determine negligence. We have a finding of fact. and a finding of fact that refuted Mr. McCoy's his spin on the facts. I don't agree with his facts. I don't agree it was a safe place. That's not the record. The jury rejected those arguments. They said you were negligent. We knew that that's all we had to prove if we were right, our interpretation. And we argued, we brought it here, and we thought that this court said we were right. And then we went back and we came into this quandary where the court says, yes, the Supreme Court did say that the legislature is punishing, but I don't want to punish this person. But for what reason? The legislature said they're entitled to double damages. It's not a punitive damage. We didn't have to prove clear and convincing that this malice, this state of mind, there isn't that kind of component to a remedial statute. Double damages have been around forever. The courts have enforced them. They have held that they are constitutional in nature. And my light is on, and I respectfully request that you reverse. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Thank you, Mr. McCoy, for our second argument on fires and damages thereof. And we will now conclude our hearing on 10-AP-355 Heritage Farms, Inc. versus Markel Insurance Company. The court will take a few moments of recess so that the Albany High School students may leave if they wish, and James Madison Academic Council students may come into the court. We are in recess for a few minutes.